All right, ladies. Up, 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 up.
This is Jason Albert, and you are listening to the Faster Skier Podcast. In this episode, we talk with former U.S. ski team member and two-time Olympian Holly Brooks. Brooks recently made her retirement from elite-level sport official. Brooks' path to the U.S. ski team was anything but traditional. She claims she wasn't the junior phenom of her former U.S. teammates, never made NCAAs, all along skiing simply for the love of sport. Then, after years coaching at Alaska's storied APU, all the hours coalesced. Brooks became one of the fastest skiers in the nation. This interview ranges beyond the realm of stopwatches and sport into something very personal. During her time training and racing, Brooks was without her period for 8 years. And now she and her husband are having trouble starting a family. Add to that a newly minted master's degree in clinical psychology, and Brooks's life is busy and filled with real-world stuff. I'll let Brooks introduce herself as we get the interview underway.
My name is Holly Brooks. I grew up in the heart of Seattle, in a place where cross-country skiing is not a thing. I went to Junior Olympics for a couple years for probably six times for the Pacific Northwest. I grew up with my dad as my coach and my siblings as my teammates. For most of my life, I was a very mediocre skier. I skied at Whitman College and never made NCAAs. Then after college, I moved to Alaska, and this is kind of where my ski career blossomed. I became a high school ski coach and then a ski coach for APU. And my saying is that I skied for fun and I skied for work, and that ended up being a whole lot of skiing. So I made my first Olympics at the age of 27, made the U.S. ski team about 9 days before my 30th birthday, and then had a short but really rewarding career from the Vancouver Olympics to the Sochi Olympics, and then had kind of a 1.5 year celebration or hoorah after my exit from World Cup skiing.
So I'm curious, you said a mediocre skier. How do you define mediocrity?
Yeah. And by using those words, I certainly don't want to offend anyone else who, you know, was at my level or who is at my level or who was, you know, other people who don't have podiums at Junior Olympics. That's not my intent, but it's always relative, right? All my other U.S. ski team teammates were kind of phenoms from, you know, age seven. You know, you had Sadie Bjornsson, who was beating all the boys for, you know, the first couple years of her ski racing career. So it's hard to define mediocrity, but, you know, if you looked at my results from Junior Olympics, I was 40th, I was 50th, maybe I popped at 22nd. You would never expect Holly Brooks, you know, later in life to be a two-time Olympian.
When you and Eric Flora, who's the coach over at APU, look at your data in hindsight, like, what do you guys attribute your, like, quick rise to?
Really, I think it's love for the sport. I know that's not a physiological answer, but it really truly is love for the sport. When I moved to Alaska, I was coaching and skiing for work, but then also skiing for fun. And my style as a coach was to kind of jump in with the interval, with the juniors on the intervals, and, you know, maybe either lead one or follow. And I could see what they were doing throughout the whole interval, not just standing on the side of the trail. You know, and then I met my husband, Rob Whitney, who's a former, you know, U.S. ski team skier, and he went to world championships twice. And then I also came up here and met friends and met peers who, you know, they all skied in high school and some in college. And I was just so blown away to have so many friends that enjoyed the same thing that I did, that I just ate it up. And, you know, so I was skiing probably, I don't know, 4 to 8 hours a day for a couple of years coaching. And I really had no realization at the time that it was the perfect base for you know, becoming a fast skier and then adding some intervals and some racing to that was ironically all it took, I guess.
Was there one race in particular where you had that aha moment, like, holy smokes, I could give it a go here?
Yeah, well, it was kind of a series of races because it took me a long time to internalize the fact that, oh, that's a real result. Because I would have these results and just come up with excuses like, oh, it's the end of the season, everyone's tired, or, oh, you know, I just had really good skis. But yeah, I entered the Tour of Anchorage for the first time. I can't remember if it was 2007 or 2008. And I won it. And that was really, really cool, really fun. And then also Spring Nationals were up in Fairbanks one year. And I actually went as a coach and APU. We were sharing a waxing cabin with the U.S. ski team at one point. So I would go back and forth between waxing skis, you know, for other people on the APU team, and then kind of joking around with Matt Whitcomb, who was also waxing skis, you know, who later became my coach on the U.S. ski team. But, you know, I had a couple, I don't know, I had maybe a podium and a fourth place in races up there. So that was cool. And then also the first time I did the American Birkebeiner, I was in a photo finish with Rebecca Dussault for the win. And so it kind of took a series of races for me to really say, okay, there might be something here.
You know, we always think about, oh, well, the team's going to bring up people they can cultivate for a decade, because you hear all or you read literature about it takes a certain amount of time at a certain level to get someone to perform at the world, you know, top 10 World Cup level. I'm just curious, what were those conversations like? You know, it's like, I'm in my third decade here. What am I thinking?
Well, I guess I would just go back to say the first person that really believed in me was my husband, Rob. You know, we would ski together and he would say, Holly, you're skiing really fast, or you're skiing really well. And I was like, ah, no, you know, and he was the one that talked me into doing all these races in the first place. And when I would write off a certain performance or result, he would say, no, that's for real. You know, and he would nudge me into the next one. And so he was kind of the first person that really pushed me in that direction and really kind of inspired me and believed in me. So that was kind of the first thing. And then the other thing I remember is I went to the Canmore World Cups as a coach, and I was actually skiing some of on the World Cup course with some of my coaches, actually Frode Lillefeld, who is a former APU coach. And he turned to me and was like, you should be racing this thing, not coaching. That was kind of an aha moment too, or at least a funny realization.
On the U.S. ski team, you know, there's been lots of stories about the close-knit team camaraderie, in particular on the women's side. What was your place on that U.S. ski team?
You know, it's funny because I was maybe the oldest member of the team in terms of numerical age, birth date, what have you, and probably the one with the most life experience and perspective. But then in terms of a ski racing career, you know, like I've kind of discussed, I was the youngest. So I probably had the least international experience, but the most life experience. And so I think my role on the team was kind of the one to help put things in perspective for people. You know, athletes can be so focused and it's really easy to get a narrow mindset. And I think I was kind of the person that always spoke up and said, hey, you know, why don't we run this new trail instead of, you know, the same warm-up loop that we've been doing for, you know, for years. And, you know, so I think I had different ways to kind of keep it fresh. And I think keeping things fresh is really important for keeping things fun. And keeping things fun is really important for not only longevity in the sport, but performance and sustainability. So I think if I had to name my role, that's what it was.
And this is sort of a wide-ranging question, but a highlight skiing moment.
If I had to name kind of one moment in time or one highlight, you know, it would definitely be the Yalavari Relay. And that was the first time that the women's team had a podium finish in the 4x5 relay. And I was the scramble leg. The relay was the second event of the weekend. And the day before, I had my career individual best World Cup result of fifth. I think I was like 3.8 seconds from the podium. And that relay day was just awesome. You know, and being the scrambler, you know, I was kind of riding the high of my individual result the day before, had my relay socks on, you know, had a starting position right at the front of the group of girls. And I mean, just the constant adrenaline. I mean, I think I finished my leg and then my heart rate stayed in level four for the rest of the relay, you know, watching Keek and Liz and Diggs, you know, kind of bring it home. That was a really, really special moment.
That's a nice group of names to be associated with right there.
Oh, heck yeah.
So this brings us why you might be in the news cycle once again. I think I came across your name recently, just, you know, I was reading up on the Mount Marathon race and I was like, oh, Holly, I guess, isn't going to jump in it this year. And I think that was around the time when you officially retired, if I have that sequence correct. I suppose you're officially retired from ski racing at this point.
Yeah, well, it's kind of weird because I more or less retired a year ago, if not more than a year ago, but I just never really said anything. The word retire for me is kind of a hard word because some people are in a sport and they retire and they kind of cut all their ties and they quit cold turkey. And I didn't want that. I knew that I wasn't going to do that and I didn't want that expectation of me. And I was kind of afraid of the label of being a retired athlete. You know, I didn't want to limit myself in any opportunities I might have had. And so I just never announced anything. And, you know, the year after Sochi, I did a full year in Europe racing ski marathons. And that was an amazing experience. And then the year after that, I knew I had been pursuing a master's degree at Alaska Pacific University, and I had a 600-hour internship to complete. And I knew that I couldn't do that with racing. But I guess my last hurrah was the tour of China, which was an amazing experience. But yeah, the whole retirement announcement officially came up because the Alaska Dispatch News had called me and asked if I had planned to participate in Mount Marathon this year. And I said, no, you know, I don't know if you know it, but I'm actually kind of retired and I'm really actually quite out of shape. And they said, oh, well, I mean, we noticed that you hadn't been racing much, but, you know, we didn't want to put words in your mouth and, you know, we didn't want to ask that. That might be considered rude. After, you know, Mount Marathon happens, can we do a story on that? And so I was actually an announcer for Mount Marathon this year. That was much different than wearing a bib. And after that, I did an interview with longtime ADN reporter Beth Bragg, and then it came out in the paper. To tell you the truth, I have been so busy that I wasn't fully prepared for, you know, the feedback I would get from my retirement article. And it, you know, I didn't exactly plan the announcement very well. I mean, there were probably a bunch of people, and there still are a bunch of people that I should call and really kind of have that career ending conversation with. But I'm so busy and so distracted by all the things I'm doing now. My degree is a master's in counseling psychology, and the path I'm moving towards is becoming an LPC, a licensed professional counselor. And you have to have 3,000 supervised hours and pass a big national board exam, you know, to have that designation. But I am trying to start my own business, my own practice, and it's going to be Holly Brooks, LLC, coaching, counseling, and consulting. And I hope to work with athletes on a variety of issues and topics but kind of the primary one being helping particularly female athletes who are developing reach their goals, whether they're dealing with performance anxiety or eating disorders, or, you know, there are some team dynamics that aren't working out quite right, or if they need help navigating a transition from maybe sport to retirement, or, you know, high school sports to college sports, or college sports to professional sports, you know, anything like that. You know, I'm also excited to help prepare people for special events. So maybe it's writing a training plan, you know, or maybe it's a speaking engagement, or, you know, for example, later this weekend, I'm headed to Juneau to give a speech to all of the superintendents in the state of Alaska, and advocate for more time to play in our schools for elementary school students. So, you know, it's a business with a big variety of opportunities, and it's a great way to kind of meld my life as a professional athlete with my academic background and credentials. So I couldn't be more excited about that, and it gives me a huge sense of purpose moving forward.
You know, was there anything else going on in your life at the time that prompted you to think about retiring?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, besides wanting to finish up school and graduate with my master's degree, you know, I knew that I wasn't getting any younger. And Rob and I really want to start a family. You know, a lot of my ski racing peers are doing that now. You know, this year was kind of a baby boom on the World Cup. And then also with my friends here at home in Alaska, I knew, and I've known for a while, that process had the potential to take some time. I actually went 8 years without having a period. And at the time, I didn't think about it so much. I knew in the back of my head that it was not a healthy thing. You know, I had spoken with some of the doctors and the physiologists at the U.S. ski team about it, and I had some DEXA scans to check my bone density and whatnot. But at the time, I didn't want to mess around with the birth control that I was on to try to get my period back. I didn't want to do a bunch of hormone therapy because I didn't know how my body would react to it, and I didn't know what that would do to my performance. And so with the decisions I had to make, I knew wanting to start a family that it would take some time. And I've kind of been going down that path of, for one, trying to get my cycle back, which took 8 months of hormone therapy and working pretty closely with doctors. And now I have been seeing an infertility specialist for more than a year now. And so, you know, it's something that people don't talk about very, very openly. But I feel like it's important to talk about and kind of remove some of the stigma from that. And then also work to kind of educate other athletes, you know, female athletes, on kind of the hardships of amenorrhea and some of the lasting consequences that it may have on your life. And so right now I'm actually partnering with a friend who's a sports dietitian. Her name's Ricky Keen. And we're preparing to go around to all of the high school cross-country running teams. And we're going to do presentations on the female athlete triad. And that is, you know, disordered eating or lack of energy can cause amenorrhea or lack of a period, which can also cause osteoporosis or low bone density and or trouble with infertility later in life. And so, you know, I'm pretty passionate about the topic because of what I'm going through right now. And when I was younger, I had no idea that this really even existed. No one ever brought it up to me. And, you know, I think the majority of coaches out there, you know, whether it's soccer coaches or hockey coaches or whatnot, you know, I'm willing to bet more than half of coaches for female athletes are men, you know, who probably aren't going to bring it up either. So that's something that I'm going through now. You know, that's quite personal, but I definitely feel a need to kind of bring it up and talk about it, try to help remove the stigma and educate other people about it.
This is probably universal. There's just a lot of pressure on youth to have results. And when, say, a young girl somehow learns, or maybe they're not learning, maybe they just start to associate their, say it's a runner, their track times with low body weight, or, oh, I haven't had my period in a year or two and I'm running faster.
Exactly.
You know, how do you navigate that duality of, you know, we live in a culture that's probably very performance driven, but at the same time, there may be health consequences for girls and women.
Right. Yeah, that it's a really hard thing to navigate. And there is lots of pressure on athletes and, you know, on athletes younger and younger and younger. Kids are kind of not forced, but, you know, people are specializing in a single sport younger and younger, you know, and, you know, at the age of whatever, 10, you know, they're doing one sport and having, you know, practice 6 days a week. And then, you know, sometimes, yeah, you can see a rise in performance, you know, especially in endurance sports. At some point, you know, you do have to haul your body around a course. and sometimes there are increases in performance with changes in your body. But what's really important and kind of the message that I am going to be delivering is that, hey, I want you to be an athlete for life, you know, and I want you to have the ability to run or ski or jump for life, you know, not just now, not just, you know, next week in your meet, but next year and in college if you want to. And I want you to be healthy for life. And so I guess what I'm going to be stressing is that going around to the different teams, I really want to help put this situation or put the situation in perspective, not only with my own experience and story, but just try to show them that there's life and a career beyond next week or next month or regions. You know, it's really easy to get caught up in the short-term results. And especially if you're, you know, getting that positive feedback of, hey, I'm getting faster. You know, this is great. It's only going to last for so long. And, you know, it's kind of like a rising star, you know, maybe you have a couple good races, but you're undoubtedly going to crash if you're not fueling properly. And I would say that personally, I think that I fueled well. I would not consider myself as someone that ever had an eating disorder. For me, I think it was a mixture of the birth control I was on and just the amount of training I was doing. But for other people, you know, maybe it is a problem with getting enough fuel or getting that fuel and then getting rid of that fuel before your body has time to digest it. The other thing that I think is really important.
Can I just stop you for 1 second?
Yeah. Yeah.
When you say getting rid of that fuel before you digest it, do you mean like bulimia or?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Being bulimic, you know, which is, you know, unfortunately quite common. I don't have the statistics in front of me, but so I think the other thing that's really important is putting positive role models in front of young girls, you know, who are dealing with puberty and the hardest, well, I wouldn't say the hardest thing, but one of the hardest things about being a female athlete is your body is constantly changing, you know, and when you're prepubescent, you know, maybe you don't have any body fat, you don't have any hips, you know, you haven't had your cycle yet. And then all of a sudden the world can come crashing down or it feels like it, you know, and when you go through puberty and all of a sudden your times, you know, may get minutes slower because your body is changing, you know, and it's maturing in the way that it should. And so that's actually a period when a lot of girls end up dropping out of sports because they're like, hey, what's going on? And they're uncomfortable in their own skin. And that's understandable. But that's why I think it's important to put healthy female role models in front of these girls, you know, whether it's US ski team girls who have a lot of muscle or, you know, having snacks with with girls and showing them like, hey, you know, I like to eat and, you know, I'm not afraid of fat. And, you know, this is what I do before a training. This is what I eat for breakfast. Then I'm really careful to get, you know, to get a post workout or post race snack in, you know, within 20 minutes of finishing, you know, when you're in that glycemic window, when you can refuel or replenish your fuel. So I think it's a mixture of educating them about the longevity of what your athletic career can be, and then also the physiological things that can happen to your body if you're not careful, and providing the strong role model for these girls. You know, there are definitely lots of parts to the puzzle.
You know, you've mentioned that you've had difficulty becoming pregnant and that you didn't have your period for 8 years. And so I'm imagining that there's probably a direct correlation between the amount of training that you were doing and not having your period for that length of time.
Yeah.
Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I've spoken to a bunch of doctors about it. And I think when it first went away, I was on an IUD called Mirena. It has some hormones in it. And for some people, they have a regular cycle. And for some people, their period does go away. And the lifespan of that kind of birth control is 5 years. So, you know, 4.5 years, I switched to a different IUD called Paragard, which had no hormones, hoping and thinking that my period and my cycle would come back. But I definitely didn't take a break in training. And so I think my body had just normalized in a, hey, you know, we don't need to do this kind of state. And it just never came back. And then I got my IUD taken out 2 Aprils ago. And it took 8 months and 3 or 4 progesterone challenges to get it to come back, you know, along with having to stop training so much. I had to, at least my doctors or advisors told me that I had to gain some weight, which was really hard because I was never skinny to begin with. The whole eating thing and proper fuel and you know, what your ideal racing weight or performance weight is so individual. You know, some people can eat like crazy and still be rail thin, you know, and their ideal racing weight looks a lot different in a race suit than my ideal racing weight. I never got below 133, you know, at the height of my racing career, and I'm 5'6". And so I'm not a skinny person. And so being told that I had to gain weight and stop training and stuff my body with a bunch of drugs was really hard emotionally and physically.
You know, in your thinking now, would you associate, you know, the difficulty getting pregnant with the level of training you were doing, or, you know, are those things kind of mutually exclusive, or does one precipitate the other?
It's really, I think, almost impossible to have a proven direct correlation. You know, what I do know is not having your period for 8 years is not healthy. You know, it can lead to problems with infertility, but it's really hard to say, you know, or prove cause and effect. And there isn't a whole lot of research out there on birth control and athletes and performance and fertility, because it's a really hard thing to study, right? Ethically and, you know, morally, or whatever you want to say. So it's really hard to prove that cause and effect, but that's my theory. That's some of, you know, a theory from, you know, the healthcare team that I'm working with.
You know, I spoke to you a few days ago and it sounded like you were on some sort of medications to help promote getting pregnant. But maybe you can clarify that. And how do you physically feel?
You know, I am pretty much in the worst shape I've been in 10 years. And that feels horrible. You know, as someone who is used to being really fit, you know, as someone who's used to kind of, you know, looking in the mirror and seeing a six pack or something like that, it's like, oh man, I don't look the same. I don't feel the same. My clothes don't fit the same. And so, I mean, you know, I don't feel bad, but it's all relative. You know, it's a new norm for me. And now that I have my period back, I, you know, I'm going through other measures. You know, I'm not doing IVF yet, but there's another technique called IUI, intrauterine insemination. And so that's another technique where you have to get shots of follicle stimulants and, you know, shots to ovulate and whatnot. And so it never feels good to put a bunch of foreign things in your body, and especially things that are going to affect the way you feel, the way you think, yeah, and consequently the way you act. So it doesn't feel great, but it's what I need to be doing now, and I've kind of come to peace with that.
Anything else that you want to add that, you know, the stuff we've been kind of chatting about?
Yeah, I guess I would say the day that my article was posted in the Alaska Dispatch News, you know, I received tons of messages from friends and family and, you know, people I didn't even know. And I got this mention on Twitter, and it was one of my followers saying, "Oh, I'm so sad, you know, today two of my favorite athletes retired in the same day." And I was like, "Oh, really?" You know, and I looked at who else was tagged in her tweet, and it was runner Lauren Fleshman. And actually, you know, she's a really, really accomplished runner. She had a huge retirement story in the New York Times, so she's a big deal. And I think the New York Times actually called her the best American distance runner to never have made the Olympics. And, you know, she somehow managed to get injured every 4 years, but she's a five-time NCAA champion. And I think what I respect most about her, aside from, you know, her performances and results, are just how she's chosen to go about her career. She's definitely been an advocate for women's rights, whether, you know, it was leaving Nike because they used their male athletes in their ads, and then they used female models for their ads instead of their female athletes. She's been really, really outspoken just about the struggles that she's been through, and she's just really approachable and human. I think the most likes or whatever she ever got on Twitter was when she posted some postpartum pictures of her body after giving birth to her baby, and she said, "Hey, look, you know, I can have cellulite on my thighs too." And so anyway, she has this great website that's asklaurenfleshman.com, and she is just a really, really amazing role model and advocate and athlete. And, you know, I went to her site, and she ended up posting this video that really, really resonated with me. And it's called From Retiring to Rewiring. And, you know, kind of the essence of the video, and then she had a poem that I'd love to read here in a second, was just about rewiring your brain to think about looking forward to the future and the opportunities that you have. And the fact that you don't always meet your athletic goals, but that can be okay. And there's still lots of things to look forward to. So, you know, I got this tweet when I was lying in bed at midnight, you know, and then I found the video and I watched it, you know, six or seven times. And here I am sitting at my kitchen table, you know, crying at my computer. And everything she said just resonated so deeply with, you know, what I've really been going through for the last year and a half. You know, and I retired a long time ago, but, you know, there's kind of a mourning process or a transition that you have to internalize. And so I would actually love to read the poem if we have time for that.
That's the beauty of audio. You have as much time as you want.
And I hope I'm not boring people.
Okay, so you want to go ahead and read that?
I would love to. And I would love to read her little interlude as well, because I think it really puts it in perspective. And, you know, if you watch the actual video, she has some wonderful guitar music in the background. So I'm not going to do it justice, but I think it's still really, really worthwhile. So she says, So I had this big fantasy that I was going to retire from professional running at the Olympic trials with one last race and say all the things I wanted to say to the sport with my feet and with my heart. I wanted to race in front of my kid on that kind of stage when he was old enough to remember it. We can get really attached to a narrative, and we want things to start or finish the way we planned. But we don't always get what we want. I'm still going to be involved in sport for the rest of my life, and I'm still going to race. But I want to see how good I can be and what I can do in the context of a full life, instead of shifting around my full life to be the best in the world. So it's less about retiring and more about rewiring. But I still kind of wanted to honor the end of something and the beginning of something else. So this is the poem part, and she says, "I'm ready to thank you for the opportunity to contribute, to thank the ones that gave me the love of sport and leadership and the tool to deal with all the shit that comes with growing. I'm ready to let go of my 21-year story of the pursuit of glory, to trade in my elite kit for a different fit that feels more appropriate for an athletic life outside the lines. A kit with room to put the future inside. I'm ready to forgive my body for not being perfect, to stop picking at the scab of the 1% of me that's broken, to remove the blinders of performance and see the full palette that's around me and start painting. I'm ready to have a new conversation besides, hey, when are you racing? To have the things I've built around my running become the things I'm chasing. I'm ready to have the things I did to fill the cracks of my broken heart become the things I aim my bow towards. I'm a falling star. I'm an arrow rising, headed for a moon I'm just now seeing. I'm an understudy taking the stage, but I'm still breathing." She's really looking forward to the future, and so am I.
Well, thank you. That was great. Thank you. And best of luck to you and Rob and navigating all of the stuff you're moving forward with.
Thanks a lot, Jason. Bye.
All right. See ya. Lastly, here's just a small plug for Holly as she is starting up a business. I asked if she had a website up and running.
Cool. And do you have a website up at this point?
I am so embarrassed to say that I don't yet. I bought my domain name the other day, though. That was a big hit because it was expensive.
Well, what will that be?
Hollybrooks.com. So, yeah.
Wow. So that existed, huh?
Okay. You may or may not want to cut this out, but Hollybrooks.com used to be a stripper.
I'm so not going to cut that out. I'm sorry.
I know. And so I would go do these school visits or at Fast and Female, and I would be like, and my website is hollyskis.blogspot.com, trying to steer people away from going to hollybrooks.com because she was actually a high-level escort. And oh, I don't know, maybe she kind of aged out of that or something, but the website became available, and I scraped my money together and finally took the plunge and bought it the other day.
So there you have it. Hollybrooks.com will be family friendly and online soon. Thanks for listening to the Holly Brooks interview. If you have any suggestions for interesting interviews, please leave a comment on the Faster Skier site or email me at jason@fasterskier.com.